75.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank you all for coming to this meeting. It's really great to see so many people here in person, and hopefully we'll get a chance to chat with all of you after the meeting is over. So I'm Susan Herman. I'm president of NAEC. We have a pretty packed agenda today. We'll get started with talking about our update for NAEC operations, talk about what we did in 2021 and what we're planning in 2022. Then we'll have presentations from Drs. Adam Ostendorf and Stephanie Ahrens on some of the data that was analyzed, both from our annual submission that you all do every year, but also the special surveys that were completed over the past year. And then we'll have a guideline update from Drs. Lotto and Susan Arnold. So my first task is to thank our outgoing board members. And we have one outgoing board member and one person who's leaving the board but got roped into something else. So Kevin Chapman, who's at Phoenix Children's Hospital, is rotating off of the board, and I really want to thank him for all of the hard work that he's put in. He's really been instrumental in helping us look at our pediatric accreditation criteria and all of the issues that touch on pediatric epilepsy care. So this is the NAEC board for 2022. The changes in the board are that Dr. Stefan Schuele is now going to be the secretary treasurer from the regular board. Our new board members are Dr. Ahmed Abdelmoidi, who is at Children's Mercy Epilepsy Center in Kansas City, and Dr. Catherine Davis, who's at the University of Pennsylvania Adult Epilepsy Center. And then the change is Dr. Miriam Bensalem Owen, who did such a great job in her role as secretary treasurer that she's now moving over to chair our accreditation committee for the next few years. I'll give a brief update on our 2021 financial picture. So we remain financially strong. Our estimated 2021 income was $555,000. We don't have all of that in yet because people are still paying dues for their next year. And our estimated expenses are $676,000, and this is because we've done some special projects that we'll talk more about throughout the day today. So we break this down into three main areas of expenses. So we have our association operations and all of the activities around accreditation, and that's about $400,000 a year. We support some epilepsy research and clinical quality improvement initiatives, as well as other special projects, and sponsor educational programs related to epilepsy, and that's about $200,000 a year. And then our annual meeting and board retreat, which used to be really cheap when we did it by Zoom, but is a little more expensive this year, is $65,000. We continue to have a very robust membership retention and a few new centers every year. So this is the set of centers for 2021. So we have a total of 261 centers broken down into adult, adult pediatric, and pediatric. And one of the things that continues to change is that many more of the pediatric centers are becoming freestanding pediatric centers rather than combined adult ped centers. And that has resulted in some changes in our accreditation criteria. And you can see that over time, we've continued to increase or maintain the number of centers even during COVID. Okay, so we've already started the 2022 accreditation process. You should have all have received your instructions and the materials for submission of your accreditation documentation for 2022. January 31st is the deadline for submission of all of the materials. So dues have to be paid by that point, and all of your surveys and all of your supporting documentation needs to be submitted to NAEC by January 31st. And then we have a two-week review and revise period. So NEAC will review your survey, review the documentation, make sure you paid your dues, and you'll have up until the end of March 1st is the final deadline. Once you've been notified if anything is missing from your application, then you have time to resubmit information. But the final deadline for dues and all of your documentation is March 1st. And we need to do that because in order to have everything reviewed and all of the final decisions made by the time that we need to submit information to U.S. News and World Report, we really have to have everything in by March. So there isn't much flexibility about that. We will again have a webinar. So we have a webinar every year in January to talk about the accreditation process, allow people to ask any questions. Please invite your administrators or any of your other staff who help you fill out the accreditation surveys and help to prepare documentation, because they're the ones who do all of the real work, and they'll be well instructed. So some of the things that are happening this year for accreditation is that the COVID-19 flexibilities that were in place for 2020 are ending. And that's based on a couple of pieces of data. You'll hear more about that in a few minutes. But when we looked at the number of centers who had trouble meeting accreditation criteria for 2020, it was actually a fairly small number of centers. That's not to say that there wasn't a significant impact from COVID. We know that everyone was struggling in some ways. Admissions were down, numbers of surgeries were down, but most of our centers were able to, even with those stressors, maintain an active epilepsy program. And so when we saw things improving for COVID-19 for 2021, we thought that this should be probably just as good as 2020 in terms of our center's abilities to meet the accreditation criteria. Now, we all understand that there's huge variability from location to location and even within locations in terms of the resources that are available. And so our accreditation committee will be reviewing any deficiencies on a case-by-case basis and making decisions about whether there's any need for individual flexibility. And we thought that this offered the best balance between maintaining very strong accreditation criteria, but also being able to make allowances for centers that were particularly heavily impacted by COVID. And so there will be a review. That review is anonymous. Only in areas where there's a lot of controversy would they need to potentially speak to the individual centers to find more details about why particular accreditation criteria were not met. So the board also debated quite a bit whether we should institute any of the new criteria that had been planned to be instituted last year, but which we delayed because of COVID. And again, we felt that these items are so important to epilepsy center operations, patient care, and safety, that we decided to put them into place. But as opposed to the old criteria, where you have to basically attest that you met it for the prior year, for these accreditation criteria, you'll have to attest that you will meet it at that time, that you submit your information, and will meet it going forward. So you don't have to think about what you did last year. You just have to be sure that you can put these processes into place and maintain them throughout 2022. So here are the new criteria. So the first is EMUs that meet certain criteria. I'll talk more about that in a second. A medical director who is board certified in epilepsy or clinical neurophysiology or equivalent, so you can submit other documentation if people aren't boarded in epilepsy or clinical neurophysiology. And then the second required epileptologist may be board eligible rather than board certified. For pediatric and for adult and pediatric combined centers, there must be a pediatric epilepsy specialist. So in the past, you could have a pediatric neurologist who wasn't necessarily epilepsy trained or epilepsy certified, and we have changed that so that centers that say that they care for children with epilepsy need to have a pediatric epilepsy specialist, and they need to submit a video EEG report from a patient under age 2. because many centers, you know, who can provide care for adolescents and adults very well may not be able to take care of very young children. So we're asking for documentation that there really is pediatric expertise in video EEG monitoring. So as I mentioned before, these criteria are prospective. So you just have to say that you meet them at the time of the submission. So the criteria for an epilepsy monitoring unit are likely to engender a lot of questions. We define an epilepsy center after an epilepsy monitoring unit after a lot of discussion as designated hospital beds where video and EEG data is captured and sent to a central location. That there is remote control video with 24/7 recording and not just a fixed camera, that somebody should be able to move around and follow the patient and be able to maintain safety. That there are trained personnel 24/7 who monitor video and EEG, and this is someone who is trained in recognition of seizures both clinically and in maintaining recording integrity. This does not have to be an epilepsy, a registered EEG technologist, but they do have to have specialized training in seizure recognition and troubleshooting. And of course, we would prefer if there is an epilepsy, an EEG technologist, but we understand that in many places that can't be done 24/7, but there needs to be a person dedicated to watching the video and watching the EEG and making sure that everything is recorded appropriately. We also require EMU safety trained inpatient nurses and epilepsy specific staff training and protocols for seizure safety, and all of you already submit a lot of protocols, management of status, criteria or protocols for responding to excessive seizures, et cetera. So most of you already meet these criteria. And then clinical decision making by an epileptologist. And that doesn't mean you need to be the attending of record, but you need to be involved in speaking to the clinical care team and directing the care in regard to the EEG monitoring. There are very significant details in the accreditation materials, and we're open to comments and to questions regarding the new EMU criteria. The other thing that we're going to require for accreditation this year is the last survey. So last year you filled out two surveys, one on epilepsy surgery and one on safety, inpatient safety for video EEG monitoring. This year's survey will be on outpatient care and sort of broader interactions with the community and a little bit of questions about what direction NAAC should go in the future. So all centers will be required to complete this. I think those of you who did the surveys last year, they hopefully were not particularly onerous and will continue that survey this year. And I think when you see some of the data that's coming out of the surveys, it's very interesting and I think will be of great use to the membership. So in light of these new criteria, as well as the expected increase in work to potentially review more centers individually, we have expanded our accreditation committee. I'd like to thank the 2019 to 2021 members, Susan Arnold, who served as the chair and really was instrumental in establishing our protocols and the systems by which we communicate with the accreditation committee communicates with the board and really putting in place those processes that allow us to really have an independent accreditation committee from the board activities, which we felt was very important. So the board sets the accreditation criteria, but the accreditation committee reviews all of the information independently of the board and then reports to the board the results of the accreditation decisions. The other members were Christy Heck, who's going to continue, and Dr. Evan Sandog from Marshville Clinic, who is going to be stepping down from the accreditation committee. So our new members, Dr. Miriam Ben-Salem-Owen, who will be our committee chair, Dr. Christy Heck from USC, Dr. Amar Cater, who's a pediatric epileptologist from Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, Dr. Megan Salvatelli at Maine Medical Center, who's our level 3 representative, and then Dr. John Stern. So I want to thank all of you for volunteering to serve on this committee and do this important work. I'm going to just review some of the activities that we did in 2021, and again, these fall into our three pillars of activities, which are standard setting, largely around accreditation, advocacy, both with governmental payers and private insurers, and then support to member centers in terms of education and resources. And all of these pillars are designed to allow us to assure quality epilepsy care by supporting strong epilepsy centers. So in terms of standard setting, we completed our 2021 accreditation process in the middle of a very active pandemic with the same efficiency and accuracy as has been done in the past. We engaged in a lot of discussions about what the accreditation should look like for 2021 and how we were going to make allowances for COVID-19. We supported the Epilepsy Learning Health System, which is a quality improvement network that is trying to standardize care and look at patient outcomes, and then also began our process to revise the NAEC guidelines, and you'll hear more about this. In terms of standard setting and center resources, we had the launch of a training program for neurodiagnostic assistants. So when I talked about what you need for an epilepsy monitoring unit, I said you need to have trained monitor watchers, trained patient observers. They didn't necessarily need to be an EEG technologist. So where do you get those people? You get them by hiring staff and having them do this training, which was developed by the American Society of Electroneurodiagnostic Technologists, now called just ASSET. This program is now available to all staff of all of our members for free. So they sign up, there's an online course that they do, there's a post-test and a certification document that's generated. We thought that this was, potentially of great use to the center, since patient observers and sort of electroneurodiagnostic assistants tend to turn over fairly quickly. You have a lot of people coming in and going out pretty frequently. And so having this resource, there are no limitations on the number of staff that you can train through this program. And the program was reviewed and approved by the NAEC board, and we think it's a very high quality program. Hopefully this will allow us to sort of take a little bit more control of that staff, who are often supervised by the nursing department rather than by the EEG and epilepsy centers. Providing these resources, I think, will create a much more qualified workforce over time. So in terms of, this is very tiny. this course is called LTM 100. It's a part of a broader online education program for EEG technologists. And so if your staff actually take this beginner course, they can then continue to take courses and eventually be eligible to sit for the ABRET certification exam for EEG technologists. Again, this is, I think, a good potential stepping stone to creating a larger number of EEG technologists, and we all know that there are not nearly enough of them. So this is the what they call the neurodiagnostic assistant. They have very specific duties that they can do as a result of taking this training program. They are not qualified to interpret or to identify seizures on EEG. They really are looking for clinical signs of seizures, maintaining patient safety, and looking for issues with the performance of the equipment so that the patients are recorded. And we really see this as probably working under the direction of an EEG technologist who is registered as part of a neurodiagnostics team. The second part of our sort of educational initiatives was to partner with the AANN, the American Academy of Neurologic Nurses, to develop epilepsy center-specific training for nurses. So AANN was looking, was developing already a six-module course to train nurses in epilepsy. And they came to us and they said, you know, would you support this course financially and also in terms of getting the word out about the availability of the course? And we said, well, yes, we'd be really happy to do that, but we'd like to actually add and support two additional modules. So the first six modules are appropriate for all nurses who work in neurology and need to know how to recognize and recognize seizures and manage epilepsy from a nursing point of view. But then there are two additional modules that are very specifically geared towards nursing in a epilepsy center, level 3 or 4 epilepsy center on the inpatient side, and then a comparable module on outpatient nursing. And these are very practical modules that go through, sort of introduce the nurses to, you know, what it means to be an epilepsy center, what are our accreditation criteria, what are our guidelines for safety, what are the duties in terms of, you know, teams and patient coordination in the outpatient setting. I really want to thank Dr. Stefan Schuele for helping to shepherd this through and for volunteering his staff to participate in the development of the program. And then some of the nurses from the Barrow Neurologic Program also participated in the development of these programs. So as I mentioned, there are 8 modules. The nurses can either take the first 6 or they can take the NEC Epilepsy Center version, which is 2 additional modules. And again, when we say in our EMU accreditation criteria that you must have specialty trained nurses, this is one way to get there. Now, this is not free because nurses need to do continuing education, and AANN is a provider of those continuing education credits. But we think that, you know, many centers will be willing to cover the cost of the programs for the nurses. Our center, for example, just got approval for us to train 30 of our nurses and do this program. So this is just an overview of the modules. The first 6 are basic epilepsy care, and then the last 2 are specialized epilepsy center. And then this is a thank you to all of the editors, contributors, reviewers, and item writers. There's, again, a certification test at the end and a certificate that the nurses have passed this accreditation program. Okay. We also worked with ACNS and AAN to provide coding information for a CPT assistant article and for Medicare contractors. We did an analysis of Medicare rules. We also provided responses on 2 sort of national policies that are being proposed by insurance companies. One was on a Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage policy on LIT, laser interstitial thermal therapy, and another that we just submitted on for Anthem on ambulatory EEG and how this should be used and whether you need to get an ambulatory EEG before you can bring somebody in the epilepsy monitoring unit. And so this, I think, gives us a significant opportunity to weigh in on how payers cover the procedures that our patients have done. And because many of these policies get developed by one insurance company and then adopted by many others, I think that this may have a sort of a snowball effect in improving the utility and the benefits of these policies for our patients. We also signed letters to Congress on prior authorization relief. I'm not sure that really accomplished much, but it was a good effort. We also provided a lot of activities, and you know, there was a lot going on despite COVID at NAAC. So we had several webinars. We did a town hall on starting the epilepsy equity conversation, and then another town hall on optimizing care for patients with rare and genetic epilepsies, and many of you here participated in that. If you didn't have a chance to view those webinars, they're available, recorded on our website. We also drafted and submitted articles for publication based on our annual center reports from 2014 to the present, and also another article on epilepsy center operations during COVID, and you'll hear more about that in a couple of minutes, and then as usual, responded to all of our member questions. So what we'll be doing for 2022, we're going to do our 2022 accreditation cycle, and then finalize any accreditation changes for 2023. Every year, we try to identify areas where we think that there's room for improvement, tell our centers about what we're planning for accreditation, and then implement new criteria the next year. So we'll be discussing that in the spring. We're also undergoing a process to revise NAAC guidelines for epilepsy centers, and you'll hear more about that from the chairs of the guideline committee in a few minutes. And we also have our upcoming publications, both on the center data, but also on the surveys that you all completed. For advocacy, we're going to look at the CPT codes. At some point, those CPT codes that were implemented in 2020 will come up for re-review. We're not going to do anything to make that happen early, because nothing good happens when your codes get on the CPT table. we expect that they will probably resurvey the codes within the next 2 years, because there was such a large family of new codes that was developed. We've also been doing advocacy with private insurers, and we'll continue to do that, particularly around some of these new items like LIT and ambulatory EEG, analysis and advocacy for the Medicare rules, and then expanded collaborations with AAN, AES, ELC, and EF. So one of the things that was done during COVID is that we created a sort of a response task force to look at everything that was going on with COVID, meet on initially every other week basis to talk about what the other societies were doing, and to put in place a plan to make sure that every constituency of epilepsy, from the patients to the professionals, was covered. And we continue to do that. Now we're meeting quarterly, but it's a really great way for us to see what the other organizations are doing and refine NAAC's role in epilepsy care. And then finally, we are planning additional webinars, town halls. We'll continue to answer your questions. And we're also working on broadening our toolkit and resources on our research page. The other big initiative that we're doing this year is strategic planning. We're actually going to be meeting here Tuesday and Wednesday to begin our strategic planning process. You know, NAAC over the last 5 years has been really focused on developing and establishing a robust accreditation program, but that's working pretty well now, and it's time for us to think about what we're going to do over the next 5 years. So we'll be looking at our pillars, seeing whether we need to revise those at all, think about new areas where we should be providing support. We'd like to address health disparities in a more concerted way. With COVID and all of the changes that have occurred in healthcare, we suspect that there will need to be changes in center operations to meet the new healthcare criteria, and so we'll be working on that. And then we also want to kind of look at what NAAC's role is. So from the Institute of Medicine report back in, 2013. You know, they had some very specific recommendations for what epilepsy centers and NAAC should do. And one of them, the first one, was to create an accreditation program. So we're done with that. But then they also suggested things like creating infrastructure for collaborative clinical research and collaborative outcomes research to look at population health, et cetera. And so we'll be thinking about what NAC's role is in that activity. And then finally, I can't end without thanking everyone. And this list gets longer and longer every year. So I want to thank all of you who are here in this room and people who are outside to the huge amount of work that is done every year to provide services for our members. And you can see all of the different activities that have occurred. I also can't finish without thanking our staff. Our management staff is outstanding and is responsible for every good thing that happens from NAC. Ellen Riker, our executive director, Joanna Gray, our deputy director, and Barbara Small, our programs manager. And you guys probably all know them very well. They're incredibly helpful and really help NAC keep moving forward. And that's it. Questions? Okay, good. All right, so now Drs. Adam Ostendorf and Stephanie Ahrens will provide an update on the NAC accreditation data and some of the work that they've been doing over the past few years.
Thank you, Sue. Good morning. I'm Adam Ostendorf. I'm an epileptologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. I'm up here with Dr. Stephanie Ahrens, who's also an epileptologist at Nationwide. And we're here to give a little bit of an update and background on some of the data that are coming out of the annual survey and the supplemental surveys to membership. So a couple years ago, we reached out to NAAC asking some questions about the possibility of maybe working together to better understand what practices are commonplace across epilepsy centers, both individually and in groups like regions. And we wanted to characterize current practice based on these annual survey data. We want to look at the trends over time, from earlier on in the decade till now. And then we wanted to advance the NAC mission of taking these data and using the data to set standard of care and also give that data back to the membership so that we can all kind of understand where we sit in general epilepsy practice. So the data that we've been analyzing come from two major sources. One source is the annual accreditation survey, and then the supplemental surveys that y'all have filled out over the past year or so on epilepsy surgery practice, EMU practice and safety, and then an upcoming outpatient practice and future direction survey. So Dr. Ahrens is going to talk about her more recent poster presentation from yesterday showing the 2020 annual data. Then we'll talk a little bit about some of the data that will be undergone final analysis from some of the surgery supplemental data where we looked at testing patterns across centers. And then we'll finish with some data insight into the treatment patterns across epilepsy centers.
All right, good morning. As Sue mentioned, excuse me, I did present this as a poster, and this will become available online after AES. And so essentially, we kind of compared the 2019 to 2020 annual survey data to get some insight into how COVID-19 impacted epilepsy center practice in the United States. And I will highlight just a few of the key findings. So we did see about a quarter decrease in EMU admissions, but this decline disproportionately affected level 3 centers and adult centers. Some of the other measures we track actually didn't see any significant change, but something that was certainly true is that there were geographical differences. So this map here gives an idea. You can see certainly the East and South Central regions saw a greater impact from the epidemic than some of the other regions in the country. Another piece of information we looked at here is treatments provided and services. And so this table here shows aggregate procedure volumes, again, kind of across all centers. And at the bottom, you can see the summary. So total treatments declined by just shy of 6%. But actually, or interestingly, we saw a decrease in a couple of procedures, being VNS implantation and temporal lobectomies, but then actually other individual procedure volumes increased in this 2020. Another way to look at this data is by median procedure volume. So this is medians per center. And this is kind of a busy table, but I've highlighted there actually were not very many significant changes except for VNS implantation in adult centers and then temporal lobectomies among combined adult and pediatric centers. The next data we'll present is sort of a compilation coupling the annual survey data again with the supplemental survey. So specifically looking at the epilepsy surgery survey data, the first question we aim to answer is, what epilepsy center characteristics influence testing for epilepsy surgery? To try to answer this question, we've analyzed this supplemental survey we sent to all epilepsy center directors, so both adult center directors and pediatric center directors. And really the main piece of information we incorporated for this analysis is understanding how often centers utilize different testing modalities or consultations. And then finally, we also coupled, so we collated the supplemental survey with annual survey responses, and then we also included kind of U.S. census region to, again, get a sense for regional differences. This is sort of a, again, sort of a busy table, but I just wanted to highlight here, this is just a univariate analysis of, you know, how people responded to essentially what testing is included in their pre-surgical evaluation at their center. And up at the top here, this is just to highlight that most centers across both, you know, level 3 and level 4 centers, and then displayed here in this table, across different patient demographics, most people use LTM for seizure capture and brain MRI at 100%. After that, you can see there becomes quite a bit of variation in further ancillary testing. And then here I've just highlighted a subset of tests where there's clearly a significant difference in test utilization between pediatric centers and then combined in adult centers. The next thing we did for this analysis was look at a multi-step regression model. And here we're really trying to understand the associations between center characteristics and specific test utilization. So we included 15 covariates in the big model. I've listed a few of the examples here. And this gave us a lot of data, which does not all fit on one slide. But I wanted to just highlight one way that we have found this analysis really interesting. And when you control for all other variables, we do see clear regional differences. These tables are set up in comparison to centers in the South. So the way to read this would be that compared to centers in the South, centers in the Midwest utilize more neuropsychology testing, FDG, PET, and social work. And then on the flip side, compared to regions in the South, regions in the Northeast and the West utilize less SPECT.
So there's clearly a lot more data to that analysis, and we'll try to be disseminating those data through publications over the next year. In addition to looking at testing patterns, we also looked at treatment patterns with a very similar approach. So we collated data from the annual survey with the supplemental surgery survey. Now these data were a little bit more complicated because unlike testing, there were many treatments where centers performed zero of those treatments. So when we look at the data, it's a zero inflated model. So we had to use a zero inflated Poisson model to look at these data. But we wanted to also answer questions like what center characteristics increase the likelihood that the center will do at least one procedure, and then subsequently ask the question, what center characteristics increase the likelihood they do each additional procedure. So for example, when we look at the data, we see that on the left side of this graph, there are numerous centers that do zero temporal lobectomies. So that clearly skews the data in typical modeling, which is why we used a zero inflated model. For VNS implantation, again, there are a lot of centers that do zero, but it's distributed a little bit more evenly across the lower, 20 and less VNSs a year, compared to hemispherotomy, where there's a lot more centers that do zero hemispherotomies. And so this is one of the challenges when we're looking at these data. So again, a very busy slide, but this is another way that we looked at the data. And this is looking beyond the zero inflated model. So these are centers, center characteristics that all maybe influence each additional procedure at each additional center. And to highlight a couple things, you know, this is the SPECT data. So center characteristics, So if you have SPECT, you are actually less likely to do more extratemporal resections. If you have SPECT, you're actually more likely to do temporal lobectomies or more temporal lobectomies. And these are the kinds of data that we're seeing as we analyze the multivariate analysis. Similarly, when we look at palliative procedures, again, thinking about what characteristics influence how many procedures are done, if we zoom in, we see regional variation. So if, again, compared to the South, because the South would be angry if we didn't use them as the anchor, when you look at the South, the Midwest is more likely to implant VNS than centers in the South. Again, the West is more likely to use VNS than centers in the South. So this analysis is sort of hot off of our statistics press, and we're still going through it, but these are some of the patterns that we're seeing in the treatment data. So in conclusion, you know, we've definitely seen over the last decade or so that NEC member center practices are changing with time, and there's also a lot of heterogeneity amongst members and member centers. There are definitely center characteristics that influence testing and treatment patterns and what we do for our patients. But really what we need to do next is we desperately need some outcomes data to see if this makes a difference, whether we're providing SPECT or not for our patients, or PET for our patients, or if we're in the South versus the Midwest. So we'd like to thank everybody for cooperation with the supplemental surveys. Again, thank the excellent NAEC staff members. They're amazing. The board has been outstanding to work with, and we've learned a lot from this collaboration. I don't know if we have time for a few questions.
Are there any questions?
I always have to say something. So, with the proliferation of centers, it seems to me that the number of surgeries hasn't grown proportionately. So more centers doing fewer operations per center. I would ask that in the 2023 survey that they add something about fellowships, how many are paid for by each hospital. And the fellows at a level four center should be doing intracranial cases, and yet many centers aren't doing very many of those, even though they claim to be level four. And I think we need to tighten up the criteria, because there's way too many fellowships that don't have very good exposure to some of these cases. And so when they get out there and they start doing stuff, they may not have the experience to do intracranial complicated evaluations. And I think NAC needs to work with ACGME on this to tighten things up a bit. You know, if a center does zero intracranials and they've got fellows that they're claiming are getting the training, they have to document it, I don't see how that's working out. So that's something I would ask to add to the questionnaire for not this year, but next year.
Thank you for that excellent presentation. I have a question for my colleagues, center directors here. How many experienced a temporary closure of their EMU in this year, in 2021, by a show of hands? I'm just trying to get an idea. How many centers experienced a temporary closure of EMU? Thank you.
Any other questions on the data that was just presented? Because we do have one more presentation.
Thank you again. That was terrific. It is actually more of a comment than a question. If we're looking at outcomes, my hope and suggestion would be that we could agree upon how we want to track those outcomes within our own institutions. We're looking at that right now, but it will be much easier to do that prospectively, knowing what outcomes we want to be collecting and entering that into the electronic medical record, rather than being asked in a year or 2 years what our outcomes were. So that would be my ask. If we can all try to agree upon those, I'll be terrific.
Dun, dun, dun.
I just have one comment. I'm Ellen Riker, I'm the executive director. Our partnership with Adam and Stephanie came about because they wrote to us with a proposal. They had an idea about how they wanted to look at data and had the statistical team behind them. and it has turned into a partnership that we really can't say enough about. We do encourage you, people come to us and ask for our data a lot now, and we kind of come back to you with, we need a proposal, you know, we need to know the question, what you're gonna do. We try to not bother you with a lot of surveys because your time is precious, but I can't say enough about this partnership, and it really, we've been thinking about this a long time as a board, but we got a lot going on. So it's great to see what you've been able to do with this.
And we also need to thank all of you, right? Because there are very few surveys where we have 100% response rate for publication. And we're pretty close to 100% response. And the missingness of the data is very, very tiny. And that is all thanks to you guys. And so we really appreciate your filling out these surveys. I think this is going to set us up to really do strategic planning, develop our guideline process, knowing what the state of epilepsy care is right now, and think about how we go forward. So I will now introduce the last speakers, Dr. Fred Lotto and Dr. Oh, okay. And then Susan, you'll introduce Susan.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Fred Lotto. I am the vice president of the NAEC, and I am co-chair with Susan Arnold of the guideline revision committee. And what we want to do over the next 14 slides is give you an overview of both where we've been and where we're going, and a sense of what this process will entail. So this is the guideline revision update for all of you. I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of the guidelines that we have, as well as the thought process that led to where we are now. So we'll talk about the history, decision to use an evidence-informed process, and keep in mind if, for instance, we're talking about the treatment of status epilepticus, we have evidence-based guidelines, but in some other cases, the appropriate staffing ratio for an EMU We don't necessarily have data for that, so it's an evidence-informed guideline because we use expert opinion and other sources to make recommendations. And then the guideline process, I'll talk about the guideline oversight committee, the guideline panel, and we will also be soliciting input from the membership at points along the way in this process, and we'll try to outline those so that we can have the most robust and comprehensive set of questions as we go through this. So the history of the guidelines goes back really almost to the origin of the NAC shortly after. Originally in 1990, there was published a framework for the systematic, well-organized approach to subspecialty epilepsy care, a checklist of needed elements, and there was a process of self-attestation that those elements were in place. Those elements were updated in 2001, and there was a significant update in 2010, and that removed the distinction between medical and surgical centers and provided more information on referrals, guideline, team approach, safety, and quality of care. Then, as has been alluded to by Dr. Herman, in 2013, the Institute of Medicine released a report that had a big impact and recommended accreditation for epilepsy centers based on external review and validation by an external body to ensure excellence, consistency, clarity, and transparency in the provision of epilepsy care. So that there was an internal process in the NAEC, and by 2015, we had developed and piloted epilepsy center accreditation program. A separate accreditation committee was established, and throughout this process, we sought comment from our members, from the public. Finally, this process was formalized in 2016 with epilepsy center accreditation, more or less in the form that we see it now. In these 10-year intervals, we revisit guidelines, and so in 2020, we started discussing what the next revision of the guidelines should look like. And we established the guideline work group with the board in January 2020. We had a consultant who really surveyed the guideline development space with us and tried to understand what we wanted to accomplish. And really educated us as to the current standards for establishing guidelines in the U.S. and internationally to consider the scope of what we should be doing. And I have to say, in the last 10 or even longer, 15 years, guideline development, guideline science has really become established as a field and has certain quality standards and processes that need to be in place for the guideline to have legitimacy. And so more than anything, the NAC has wanted these guidelines to be accepted with a high degree of legitimacy. So the 2020, let's see where I am. So evidence review is considered an essential, am I past my slides?
No.
No, okay. Evidence review is an essential requirement for the guideline development. And we know that insurers and policy makers are going to look to the published literature to make coverage and payment policy decisions. The revised guidelines with literature and evidence review are needed to provide a published foundation for the NAC's accreditation program. And for the reasons I alluded to earlier, the board decided that we needed an evidence-informed, consensus-based process using a Delphi approach, meaning drawing together stakeholders, not just epileptologists, but stakeholders broadly, as Susan will detail, to agree on an appropriate set of guideline standards. So in 2020, we developed and sent an RFP to four parties seeking a consultant to assist with guideline development. From that round of RFPs, we chose a consultant, EBQ, was chosen. They have a track record of getting organizations like ourselves from beginning to end in this guideline development process. They have expertise and experience with trustworthy, consensus-based, evidence-informed guidelines. And the process that they detailed and outlined for us was acceptable for guideline inclusion in recognized national and international guideline repositories, which have standards that have to be met for the guideline to be considered registered and recognized. The process of developing these guidelines, so are we switching? Okay, I forgot. Susan. So Susan is going to describe this part. I didn't.
Go ahead. And we're great co-chairs, but we're still working on some of the details. So the process for guideline development begins with establishing the oversight committee. And the oversight committee's job is to really look for and eliminate as much as possible bias so that we can have a fair and balanced process for creating the guidelines so that ultimately the member centers and even non-member professionals involved in epilepsy care will see the guidelines as valid and fair. We're fortunate to have a really outstanding committee chaired by Christy Heck and David Leviner with Kevin Chapman, Lara Jehai, and Stefan Schuele. They have spent a tremendous amount of time this fall, both in the creation of the policies and procedures to form the panel, and also in individually reviewing all of the applications of our panel candidates, looking broadly, but especially at potential areas of conflict of interest, to determine whether those conflicts would prevent somebody from participating or whether that person could participate with terms of management and how those terms would look. The next step was a broad call for applications that was done in June of 2021. It went out to our NAC member centers, also to other sister provider organizations and professional organizations involved in epilepsy care, and also to patients and caregivers, both through patient organizations and in some instances through individual patients who are recommended through our member centers or sister provider organizations. We were fortunate to have well over 100 applicants, and each and every one of those applications was carefully reviewed by the Oversight Committee, looking, as I said, for bias and conflict of interest, but also looking to establish a really balanced panel, looking at the background of the applicants, geographic location, the type of center they came from. We have impaneled a group of 43 people. You can see the breakdown there. We have 17 epileptologists, so about a third, a little more than a third. Of those epileptologists, 9 are board certified in child neurology. They come fairly evenly from adult centers, ped centers, and combined adult ped centers. Most of them come from level 4 centers. We do have 2 from level 3 centers, and we worked hard to get as many as we could from level 3 centers, but that was a bit of a challenge. We have 6 people in the next category. That includes 3 people with epilepsy and 3 caregivers to people with epilepsy. We have 4 neurosurgeons, 4 EEG technologists, and I think you can see the rest of the breakdown there. The next steps in the process are the panel training, which begins this month, on both the evidence-based procedure and also on the modified Delphi process, and establishing the questions that we're going to ask in our scientific literature review. And those questions follow the PICO format, which is to be very specific about the population or the target group, the intervention, the control group or the comparison intervention, and then specifically looking at outcomes. And I think it's important to stop here and remember 3 things. The first is that we're trying to have very focused guidelines. As Fred mentioned, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. If they're already well-established guidelines, we're not trying to rewrite those or repeat that process. The second is that we're not looking to write guidelines to dictate how you make individual patient decisions. We don't want to tell you which medication to choose. And finally, we recognize, as Fred mentioned, that some of the guidelines that we are interested in, we will find very little, if anything, in the scientific literature. And that's where having a panel to come up with a guideline and then to validate it through the modified Delphi process is so important. And if the panel cannot reach consensus, then that guideline doesn't get created. Once we begin writing our guidelines, it will be done in a very standardized format that ensures consistency, readability, and understanding in as much detail as possible. There we go. And that includes the who, what, when, where, and how. In the past, for example, we would say a center has to have an epilepsy monitoring unit, and as you heard Sue mention earlier, we're already beginning to think of what that unit needs to look like. And that will be the same for other guidelines. The why for the guidelines is not part of the recommendation. It will go in the text introducing it in the paper. Finally, we recognize that even with a panel of 43, there are important voices that aren't included and that we really need to hear. And we've had a lot of discussion about how to include those voices and the people that, you know, we had to limit the panel to a certain size. And we're going to send out a request for input on guideline topics. That will go out before the end of the year. We'll go out to all of our member centers, and we'll also go out to other allied provider and patient organizations. And we really want to know, what are the things that you want the guidelines to address? We have an idea, but we need to make sure that we hear from our member centers. We are planning multiple virtual meetings for the panel in 2022 to determine the topics and then to vote and reach consensus on the recommendations. The goal is to have the process completed with guidelines ready for publication in December of 2022. Finally, we recognize, and I think all of you recognize, that as we write a new set of guidelines, a more specific, more detailed set of guidelines than we've had in the past, that that is likely to impact our accreditation process and our accreditation requirements. And I think I just want to remind everybody that NAAC has always been very transparent about what changes we are considering in the accreditation process, and has always phased that in over a period of years so that member centers are never surprised by, oh, this year you have to do this and nobody ever told you. So we anticipate that any impact on accreditation is not going to come any sooner than 2024, 2025. And with that, I think we open it for questions. And Fred, I don't know if there are questions you want to answer as well, or maybe not.
Yeah, I just want to thank the Oversight Committee members, as well as Fred and Susan, for all of the scads of work that they've done over the past few months putting this together. This is very, very different than our guidelines process of the past. We decided that we needed to move beyond, you know, eight people in a room making stuff up, and that's not really how we did it in the past, but that we needed to create guidelines that allow us to have the same standing as an accreditation organization, as other well-recognized accreditation bodies. So I hope you will be active in this process in both submitting topics to be considered. We've already heard one. We're more than happy to hear more. And then letting you know as soon as we have the results of our guidelines. All right, and if there are no other questions, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.